All right. Welcome to this edition of the Justice Team podcast. Today, we're going to talk about how to actually get paid on your verdicts, how to make them ironclad. Usually starts with having your law and motion department early and often. And today we have my esteemed partner who runs our Arizona outfit and is our law and motion head department, Mr. Travis Davis. Travis, how are you?
Good, Bob. Just flew in from Tucson this morning, you know, and I appreciate the Tucson flair here.
Yeah, I wore some Tucson nice little heavy sweater jacket, a shacket, if you will. And, you know, Travis didn't even wear his bola bow tie like a jerk.
I don't even have my boots on.
No boots. God, is he such an LA guy as soon as he gets here? Yeah, we do film from our Torrance Justice HQ location with a built-in studio. If you're watching on YouTube, it's pretty fly. If you have any, again, if you have any questions or comments, want to talk about a case, go to justiceteamnetwork.com and we will get back to you. So, Travis, let's get right into it. You recently had a $101 million verdict, which included punitive damages against Suzuki. You've had a very big eight-figure confidential settlement after a liability-only verdict up north, Northern California, San Mateo. You've been on another 10-figure verdict, which is now morphed in the bad faith case, which we can talk about too. So why don't you just, you know, educate our listeners, when do you start to get involved in these litigation cases that might be headed to trial?
Yeah, so it really depends on, you know, how the case is being worked up. On the Soulier case, you know, we've been on it since 2018.
That's a Suzuki case.
Yep. Soulier versus Suzuki, $161 million verdict on a retrial. As you know, our first trial was about $8 million. But I had been on it from before that, fighting MSJs, going down the whole path of, you know, motion to strike punitives, all of that, which obviously didn't work. We got punitives in this trial. That was the lion's share of it. But, you know, other cases, I just come in last minute. The confidential settlement that we had in San Mateo, Grayson Goody and Eric Bell asked me to join probably a month or so before the trial.
Wow.
So I came up, I did the mills.
The motions eliminate, for those of you who are listening, they may not know.
Yep.
The motions to exclude in federal court, these types of things.
Yeah, so on that one, we were able to exclude very crucial evidence, and that set us up nicely for trial. But, you know, it's for me, I think it's important to stay on board, not just to back off when my, you know, motions eliminate are heard and granted, but rather to stay on board with the trial attorneys, whether I'm in the courtroom or not. I've done both. Because oftentimes, especially on these big cases, you're hit with motions again and again.
Oh yeah, like the Suzuki case. I mean, you had three teams of defense lawyers, motions every day, motions probably for mistrial every day that you got to deal with.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Especially on that one, three national defense firms. I mean, we were briefing the court almost every day, if not, you know, every other day or so.
And are you physically there for that? Are you remote? Are you getting real-time transcripts? How does this go down?
So it just depends. And that's what's great about, you know, the way we communicate now. On that one that you're talking about that was in bad faith now, I was there every day, but I wasn't taking any witnesses. I was just there to listen, you know, watch the evidence, see what happens so that I can just go home and just start, you know, busting out whatever motions I need to write. On others, like on the Suzuki case, I wasn't there in person after the motion to eliminate hearings, but I communicated hourly with our co-counsel, you know, Gabe and Robbie on WhatsApp, and just, you know, whatever they needed, whatever questions they had, or I would ask them questions. Hey, what's the judge saying about this issue, right? Or what did this witness say? So that I can start teeing up.
Yeah, and for our listeners, I think the practical point is when you do stuff in team, I encourage you to set up chat rooms rather than just regular, you know, iChat or something. Because in other chat rooms, whether it's Slack, Teams, WhatsApp, depends on the platform, you can share documents real time. You just need a Wi-Fi.
Yeah, another thing is, you know, it's so important to get dailies from the court reporter. You know, if especially during trial, but even after trial, when you get hit with post-trial motions, you want to have everything ready. You want to have the full transcript.
Because you know what's coming. You know what they want to argue.
Exactly. Exactly. The last thing you want to do is be waiting for transcripts when you have to oppose a new trial motion or judgment notwithstanding the verdict.
So, okay. So in the Suzuki case, we had a retrial where the appellate court remanded. What are some things, and this is a product liability case. So why don't you walk our listeners through, and you know, we've tried the same type of case together, product liability, and you were there with us in person every day doing the law in motion.
Right.
Why don't you walk everybody through kind of the causes of actions that you had, the defects you had to cure from the appellate court, just so our listeners can understand when they take a case like this, what they're in for.
Sure. Yeah, it was, that's a lot. We had product liability and negligence. So in the product liability category, we had design defect, we had manufacturing defect, we had failure to warn, we had the whole gamut. And we also had a negligence cause of action. And that sort of brings in everything. It's all encompassing. You're not limited on your evidentiary presentation by having that cause of action there. In terms of the error in the underlying trial or the initial trial, the appellate court found three main prejudicial errors. And there was really one that was an issue going forward. And that was linking our client's crash to the so-called recall condition, mm-hmm. right? So when Suzuki recalled the bikes that have this type of brake system, they narrowly defined it as corrosion leading to gas buildup within the front brake master cylinder that leads to eventual brake loss of braking power, not complete brake stop.
Yeah, we had Gabe Houston on here, who was the lead in that trial and knows everything about these cases, and he was explaining some great, like, just, you know, what are they, making the average juror understand what that means. He had a windshield wiper kind of analogy. So, yeah, I mean, these things get real technical.
Very, very technical. And actually, that brings up a point. Another thing we had to brief was, what's our burden, right? So we don't just go in there and say, you know, here's our case. We actually brief the judge on on what we need to prove up this, you know, technical product liability case. And really, when you get down to the root of it, and California case law helps with this tremendously, is you have the consumer expectation test. As you know, we used in that ATV case.
Well, no, they didn't allow us to use that, remember? That was the big... Remember, the judge struck us using that. That was crazy, but...
Yeah, okay, that's right.
But, California, anyway. Why don't we walk us through the consumer expectation test? Because I think it is probably the simplest way to win in these cases.
It is.
And I do believe that it makes the most sense.
Yeah, so you can use it when it's a product that consumers can understand what its purpose is, mm-hmm. and how its defects can cause injury. Mm-hmm. Really, that's the key. In this case, sure, we have a front brake master cylinder. Who knows what that even is, right? Yep. And it has pistons and it has springs and all of this. And there's different metals that combine with the brake fluid and causes corrosion. The average person doesn't understand that. I didn't understand that before I came on to the case. But if you back up and give a, you know, have a nice view overhead of it, you have a motorcycle whose
front brake didn't work.
Right.
Pretty easy.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. That's the defect. Did the consumer, in this case, Joey, expect the brake to work when he pulled the lever? Of course he did.
Yep.
So we're able to use that test.
Yeah. And I think that's what, you know, that's why I think that cause of action makes the most sense, because you have 12 jurors that are not engineers.
Right.
I think in your jury, you did have a handful of motorcycle riders though.
Yeah.
And by the way, Travis is the only other attorney in our office that has more tattoos than I do. So congratulations.
I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah. We should do this without shirts next
time.
Yeah,
there you go.
Maybe not. This is, want to keep this PG. So anyway, you know, the consumer expectation test, let's walk us through. You also had a failure to warn.
Yeah, we had failure to warn. And that really goes to, you know, the recall, right? Mm-hmm. They knew about this issue for years. From 2007 is when they first got notice of brakes failing on these bikes. And they didn't do anything about it for, you know, the next however many years.
And then what is your, Do you give the lawyers or discuss, hey, here are the building blocks of evidence that you need to get in to win on each areas of these evidence to make sure you have an ironclad verdict?
Absolutely. So, you know, it might be overkill. I mean, we're all smart people, but for me, there's no harm in repeating what needs to be done to my co-counsel. So absolutely, I would say in this case, for example, we had an expert who was breaking expert. And he was in our first, case. He actually wasn't called in the first trial, and that was an issue on the appellate court level. But anyway, we had him in the second trial, and it was of primary importance that we had him make the connection between the recall condition and the brake failure. And so I was very repetitive on that. And we got it done.
I mean, you need that sound bite from sworn evidence at trial to use it later in the post-trial motions to win.
Right, exactly. And it really goes, I mean, that's in every case. I mean, it's not just product cases. You think about, you know, a spine injury, auto crash, right? If you have bills, right? You can have your client talk about it, but you need that sound bite of, you know, the expert saying, yes, I reviewed that bill. That's reasonable and customary in the industry, right?
It's funny. Like I always put in big bold on my outlines when I do directs of any expert in trial for the building blocks. You know, like big bold at the end, do not forget reasonable degree of medical probability and future is reasonably certain to occur. And I just say it verbatim to make sure that we get that in.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So what was the three things that on remand, the appellate court wanted you to cure on the Suzuki case that led from them? I mean, call it what it is. I mean, they went from getting tagged for $6-8 million to like 150 million or 160.
61.
Buyer beware. So what were the three things you said, hey, to cure?
So connecting the recall condition to the complete brake failure that Joey experienced.
Check.
We cured that. Yep. If the police report statement is going to come in, it would need foundation from them. This was sort of a thing that the, you know, was on the court's task of what to do. And the court, in my opinion, cured that by allowing the officer to testify in a 402 hearing in this trial. And the officer failed to lay the foundation for it. So check. Right. That didn't come in because it wasn't even a quote. It was a statement from the officer talking about how Joey's brakes locked up. Indicating that they worked, they just locked up for whatever other reason. But it wasn't in quotes. And as you know, most officers put it in quotes if it's an actual statement.
Somebody might have heard it from somebody else who heard it from somebody else, and they just write it down with no quotes.
Oh, right. Yeah. And so this officer wasn't able to remember the crash or anything about it and wasn't able to lay a foundation. So we're good there. And then the last thing was, reminded the Casey on destroying evidence.
Willful suppression of evidence.
I forgot what number it is.
203 maybe, something like this in California?
Whatever it is.
205?
Yeah, it's willful suppression of evidence. We were given that instruction in the first trial. And I think justifiably so, but the appellate court obviously found issue with it, and so we left it alone. We made a record on it because we still think that it was something that's justified. But ultimately, the court did not allow it in, so that's not an issue.
So check. I mean, you know, even if you, and I think a lot of our listeners or viewers need to understand this, is you don't have to win on every issue. Like, that makes it easier for you to win on appeal by making that concession and be like, whatever.
Right.
Whatever.
Right, exactly.
Which I always felt like, why even have that jury instruction? People, like, judges are always hesitant to give it. It's like, I mean, Your Honor, they, like, destroyed the surveillance video.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It's like, why do we have it then? But in reality, the jurors still get it.
They still get it. Obviously. And, you know, that we had that other one, the San Mateo case, that was a confidential settlement after the phase.
You could still talk about the liability phase. It's still public record.
Right. I'm talking about the settlement. Yeah. So in that phase.
It was like a six-week trial, by the way. Grayson Goody and Eric Bell tried.
Yeah, it was grueling. Yeah. So in that case, it was the most egregious spoliation that I've ever seen.
Yeah, and just for our listeners or viewers, in this case, a caretaker gets a call to fill in, take care of an elderly woman, puts her in the wheelchair, calls the elevator, turns around backwards, the elevator door opens, ding, she backs up, There's no elevator. She falls a few stories. The elderly woman falls on top of her. She passes away.
Yep.
Our client had catastrophic injuries.
Massive injuries. Yeah. And actually, we were able to get a motion in limine granted on the death of the lady that she cared for.
Irrelevant.
Because the only thing it would do is bring sympathy. Of course, it's, you know, we're, you know, obviously the plaintiff's sympathetic to that, right? It's a tragic situation,
also,
but it's not, first of all, the fall wasn't her fault.
Yeah, the owner was also the son of the woman that passed away, which, I mean, to me, I'm like, come on, you couldn't even take care of the own property your mom lived in,
right?
Whatever, you don't, it wasn't supposed to be in, but they tried.
Yeah. So in that case, they had an inspection, a visual inspection with everyone present. And then everyone agreed, let's come back later and do a destructive testing, run the elevator, see what's happening, check the oil, all of that stuff. We come back for the second inspection. It had been ran and the oil was clean. It was completely egregious. They even admitted at the hearing on the spoliation motion that they went there. But they, you know, they said it was fine because they're doing a visual inspection and trust us, we didn't mess anything up with the elevator. But yes, we ran it. It was insane.
Well, I mean, that's the stuff you got to deal with. And in that trial, you also dealing with, I mean, every day some sort of mistrial motion or something.
Yeah. So in that case, we did have a motion for mistrial. For me, you know, when I'm in sort of, you know, the heat of trial, there's so much you need to research. So I like to use, you know, lots of sources, right? But one that's really nice, that's sort of changed the way we've practiced recently is, you know, artificial intelligence, AI. Mm-hmm. And Case Text is a great example of that. You can go on there and type in, it's like you're texting, you know, another attorney. Hey, yeah. what are the rules on, or what's the standard for a motion for mistrial? Right. And it just pops up. So that's super helpful.
Yeah. And I think that was the time whenever, and I think we were talking Case Text, you know, by the time this airs, we'll have a discount 10% off for our listeners. We'll drop it into the link into the bio of the feed. You know, at that point, I think we were still test driving on behalf of co-counsel to see, or it's Case Text's product co-counsel to see how well it could be used. And I remember one issue being there was something archaic rule about the local rules in San Mateo, and the defense was trying to do something. And was just literally asking co-counsel the question that gave Grayson the answer. We sent it to him on the chat and he won that issue. But yeah, so like, I mean, AI is going to be, should make your job a lot, well, a compliment to your job, make it easier.
Yeah, it's a compliment for sure. It's a tool that you can use. I mean, we're testing other programs where, you know, it drafts an entire motion for you. But just like if you have an associate draft a motion, right? If you're filing it, you need to look at it. That's just simple, right? That's an ethical rule that we're bound by, and it's a good, I mean, it's a practical rule because, you know, ultimately you're the one in there telling the judge, you know, this is your position, and if it's not right on paper, well, you know, that's on you.
Yeah. So, have you tried just to run one of these AI products against an associate and see who did a better job?
I won't name any names. No, I'm just kidding.
No.
I haven't done that.
Man, that'd be a good little test. Yeah. So again, let's go back to, you know, our listeners are probably interested in kind of the setup on some of these like product liability cases. We talked about failure to warn. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's no recall, and I remember the case that we had, it's literally the sticker or the warnings were not efficient, or they weren't in the handbook, or they weren't available to the consumer. I mean, do you have to win on every one of these issues to get to damages, or can it just be one of these issues to get to damages?
To answer your question, just one. Wow. If you win on product design defect, you're good. Manufacturing, you're good. You know, whatever. And the Suzuki case, we won on every single count.
How many counts?
I think that would be, well, the three products and the negligence. I think there was maybe one more, maybe a warranty or something.
There's also an issue on comparative on your client and also another vehicle that they said caused the original collision.
Yeah. So in this case, you know, if Joey had the brakes that, you know, should have been on the bike, then he would have been able to stop. There wouldn't have been any issue there. Of course, this, you know, the lady in the SUV pulled out in front of him, right? She created the danger, but under normal circumstances, he would have been able to break and would have been no problem.
No comparative on them. It was 100% on Suzuki.
Yep.
All right. So tell us about, you know, when you, okay, you get, you have this ironclad verdict now. You've cured what the appellate court asked you to do. You get this $11+ million verdict on the compensatory damages, and the jury checks that box on willful malice, oppression, or fraud.
Right.
What evidence do you need to get there?
To get to that point? To ask
that question. How do you get there?
Well, we present, I mean, in this case, we had, through the work of Gabe, we had all of these internal emails that talked about Suzuki's knowledge, deep knowledge of this issue, knowledge for years, going on for years. Of course, they said, well, we don't know the root of it, right? So what are we to do? Well, what you're to do is pull the product off the market, right? Who cares what the sales, you know, effect is, right? They acknowledge, and it's obvious, that a brake issue is a matter of life or death, mm-hmm. right? So if you know there's an issue, then you pull the product, right? And they didn't. They tested it internally for years until they finally found what the issue was. And then even still, they didn't cure it right away.
But can this just be like a rank and file manager of Suzuki, American Suzuki? I mean, how do you get it on a company, those punitive damages?
Well, these were top executives. So, I mean, it was pretty clear this is, you know, this runs deep in the company. I mean, there was an email from about a year before the recall talking about, okay, we need to initiate this, but it's you know, sales season is coming up and it's going to affect that. Mm. I mean, that's like, that's so damning, you know?
So then you get that box checked. Yes. All right. Now you enter into the punitive damages phase, mm-hmm. right? I mean, do you have any, you know, this case right now is still could go on appeal. Suzuki will likely never, ever try to pay anything unless they're forced to. You know, after you get that verdict, you go to the punitive damages, you get that award. What are the next steps? Let's talk about what do you do to protect the verdict after the verdict happens? What's next?
Well, the judgment was just signed recently, so that's starting the deadline for everything. So we're going to be filing our memorandum of costs. We have a huge amount of costs in this case because we've tried it twice, right?
I think it was $700,000 or $800,000 last I saw with recoverable costs.
Yeah. Plus interest. And you put interest, just a little, you know, tidbit for the listeners. You put your prejudgment interest on the memorandum of costs.
Yeah, and I think some people make mistakes about that is they don't put the prejudgment interest on it. Yeah. So it's another big, big practice point. You can reach out to Travis or go to justiceteamnetwork.com and ask us for an example. But you have that judgment's important. It has to be right.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. And we ran into that issue on a case years ago, mm-hmm. and we had to eventually do a 473B motion, which basically means we messed up, right? So don't mess up. Just put that on there. It's you put it on the last line, the other, and it's funny, it's other, and then it's your gigantic, you know, prejudgment interest. But that's where you put it. Yeah.
Yeah. And some defense counsel will just salivate and wait for the judgment. Like, oh my God, they forgot it. Ha 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 ha. Then, you know, this one's as tens of millions good for forgetting. Okay.
So, anyway, to your question about protecting it, you know, we're ready to fight these post-trial motions, right? I know that, you know, something's coming, a new trial motion, potentially a remitter, mm-hmm. you know, as the alternative.
Remitter just means you could say to lessen the verdict.
Right. And, you know, everyone I talk to talks about, you know, the multiplier,
ratio,
right? The ratio between our compensatory and our punitives, which I get, you know, it is a big gap. But we'll be ready to fight that. I mean, there's case law that supports it, egregious this is.
Yeah, I mean, it's right in line with what kind of the Supreme Court said, I mean, with the ratio. So I think, I mean, it's all should be well and good. You know, if the jury went and said $2 billion, you might have a problem.
Right.
But not, you know, they didn't give everything you asked for punitive. So, you know, it should be. And I think it's the right thing to do. And so what happens, okay, now, one of the other things kind of that's not under your control is they'll claim perhaps juror misconduct.
Yeah. So that's another thing that's really important is you need to get in right away, right after the verdict's read and you're dismissed from the courtroom, go talk to the jurors, yep. right? I mean, you want to anyway, right? You've been working this case up for however many weeks and you're curious. You finally get to actually speak
to. Have you watched that movie or that show Jury Duty yet?
No, you're talking about that.
Oh my God, it's so funny. But they make a guy, he's the only guy that's not in it, that everybody's an actor, is just a guy that they interview like throughout the process of his jury duty selection. And
yeah.
They get sequestered and it's fucking hilarious. Like James Marsden's just one of the jurors, but it's actually him. And he's just like so pissed off he's there all the time. It's really funny.
That's awesome.
Like, yeah. But just funny shit happens all the time.
Yeah. Nice.
Oh man.
So we talked to the jurors. Robbie did. Robbie, yeah. I mean, Robbie's like, he's one of the most personal people that we know, you know. So he gets in there and talks to them and, you know, makes sure that they decided it right. And sounds like they did. So I think we're
good. Yeah. And, you know, one thing after a lot of verdicts that I've had over the years, like when I'm building up to what I know will likely be a large verdict, you can usually tell, read the writing on the wall, is I'll hire an investigator to get all the information for the jurors, you know, that are already in the box. So as soon as the verdict is read, some of them leave and disperse, want to go home, some want to stay and talk. You might not get a chance to. The other side, just so your listeners know, they're hiring the same people to call jurologists that are doing nothing other than to say, hey, I'm studying the science of why people get verdicts. They're there just there to try to get declarations from jurors to say stupid things of why the verdict should be taken away.
Yeah.
So what I do is affirmatively get all their information, reach out, have lunch, discuss their experience and tell them, hey, you don't have to talk to me. You don't have to talk to anybody. It's up to you. You know, the other side might hire people to say, do X, Y, Z. This might be the reason they're doing it. It's totally up to you. You know, you can talk or not talk, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. And if you're on the side of getting juror declarations, either to protect your verdict or to fight a bad verdict, you know, really read up on the rules of admissibility of these.
It's wild because it's opposite of what you would think, right?
Yeah, you can't say, oh, I thought this, and that, you know, that swayed it. No, it has to be an open discussion amongst the jurors.
But they can say what they heard other people say.
Yeah, it's
which is weird.
Yeah, it is weird. A lot of hearsay.
A lot of hearsay that you're allowed to get into these juror declarations. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's usually the judge is also the 13th juror there. They were there, lived and heard it and breathed it.
Right.
So.
Well, especially this judge. I mean, he heard it twice. He heard all of it, you know, and he knew what the issues were in this case. So
well, he made the decision. He knows. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Honestly, he made it tough on us, but I'm thankful that he did because he made sure that we laid the foundation for every single piece of evidence. And we did.
Yep. All right. So, you know, we're at the end of the half hour session that we have here, Travis. So what are just some parting words of wisdom you can give to those young lawyers or any lawyer trying a case to make sure that they protect their verdict?
If you're able to, and you have the team like we do, have somebody in there to focus on everything that's going on and to brief the court as often as possible so that your record is absolutely clear. Of course, you have a court reporter there and you can orally argue, but to me, there's nothing like sitting down, getting all of the case law, and putting it succinctly on the record.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of other listeners, you know, they think they're afraid of costs and things like this. There's a lot of attorneys that are do it for equity points or smaller amounts to be there, to be your pen, to be your pencil, to put it to paper, to put it to pad, and get it filed with the court. You know, a lot of times now they could sit there with products like the co-counsel and be able to assist them. But I think trial lawyers in the moment have to be concentrating on what they do best.
Right.
So that you could do what you do best.
Exactly.
Yeah. And another practical point is being a trial lawyer has done a lot of these over the years. Don't go for the home run every single trial if it means that you might lose your verdict.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, a lot of people try to get in too much or try to play too fast and loose. And you know how many times I've seen verdicts that are very large that get taken away.
Yep.
Because of stupid shit.
Right. Exactly.
Stupid shit.
Yeah.
Don't cheat. There's no need to cheat. You got to get a clean verdict.
Absolutely.
Yeah, man. All right. Well, if you have any questions or concerns, go to justiceteamnetwork.com. Click on that tab. If we have any questions, we'll hear you. Travis Davis, thanks for coming on and get your ass back to Tucson.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, I'm leaving today. See ya.
I was a poet, didn't even know it.